Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapy, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. My name is Kate Shannon, and I am your host. I'm very excited about today's episode. I had so much fun talking with Amanda. I started following Amanda on Instagram and quickly became like, I think I've probably liked every single one of her posts because you just find people on social media where you're like, yes, yes, yes. And she is one of those people. She's one of my people in that way. And we talk about that too, kind of like finding your people on social media. But so Amanda is, she is a play therapist, and she works with children, she works with young teens and young adults, and she also has this really awesome book that she wrote recently. It's an anger management skills workbook for kids. It's so cool. It is jam-packed with different activities, and so we talk a lot about that in today's episode, how to work with children who are experiencing anger in the moment in sessions, different directive ideas as well. She names a couple of those from the book, how to help parents navigate that in the moment. And then we also just talk a little bit about play therapy in general, especially some child-centered techniques and how to balance when you have a non-directive approach, but you bring in directive activities. This is one of my favorite things that Amanda so eloquently spoke about, was how you can do both, and that you can find a way to serve your clients' needs in the best way possible by pulling from those different approaches that work best for the client at that moment. Also, when I did this recording, actually it was afterwards, I had some issues with my microphone that I didn't know until after interview was done. So I had to edit a couple different things and had to re-record a couple elements. So if things sound a little bit off, it's probably because I had to edit some of those things. But this interview is just one of my favorite interviews, so there was no way I wasn't going to not release it. Side note, I'm going to do a full plug here for Music Therapy Technic, because I'm so thankful that it's around now, but I wish it was around even longer ago and I could have used it so much with different technology and trying to figure out different things like, why is my microphone not working and how do I start a podcast and all of these awesome things. So if you haven't heard about the Music Therapy Technic, it is a collaborative space, and there is a website that's going to be in the show notes as well, so you can see that there. Go check it out. This is a space where you can go and learn about podcasting, video editing, lighting, all these different things related to technology and therapy. And it is so awesome. Gabby from Clinical Populations, she's headed this whole thing and just put together like the most beautiful resource. So if you are anything like me and constantly have tech oopsies all the time, you're going to love the Technic. All right, so enjoy this episode. Definitely check out the show notes, and I will talk with you on the other side. All right, Amanda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
I am pumped and thrilled to have you here. Do you think, to start us off, you could let us know a little bit about what you do with your practice?
Absolutely. So I am a licensed professional counselor and a registered play therapist. So I work mostly with children 3 and up in play therapy. I also love working with teens and young adults, but play therapy is the majority of my work at this point. I'm mostly non-directive, especially with the little ones, meaning that I allow them to lead. They get to decide what they want to play with and what they want to talk about, or if they even talk at all. But I also really enjoy being creative in my job and coming up with activity ideas, especially for my older kids and teens.
Ooh, I love how you just touched on non-directive as well as activity ideas. How do you balance both of those? I've found this throughout my career, trying to find a way to balance that. How do you end up doing that?
That is a tricky balance, I think. I always start off from a non-directive stance, especially when building up the relationship. And I find that so often with most kids in most situations, the non-directive works really well. But sometimes, you know, with older children, they don't really feel as comfortable with it, or even younger kids, it may not be quite the right fit. And I never feel like any kind of therapeutic approach is a one-size-fits-all strategy. We have to be able to adapt with what the kiddos need from us. So definitely start out with non-directive, but if I'm getting the sense that a child needs more, or I'm wanting to teach them a skill of some sort, then I kind of step into directive a bit more. But even then, it's a very careful balance. I try to match activities with their interests, and if they're really pushing hard and not interested, not feeling safe, I don't push on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest struggles, especially young therapists, I know I had this when I first started, was trying to find, when do I use non-directive? Is that bringing activities in with non-directive okay?
Yeah.
It feels like a boat going back and forth. So
it really does. You just don't know what a kiddo is going to bring to you. And sometimes when they walk in the room, the idea of being in charge is frightening for some kids. And I've seen kids just stand there and not be able to choose anything, not be able to talk. They're just almost like shaking with anxiety. And in those moments, I'm like, I'm not going to make this child stand there and work this out in this first or second session. So I'll pull out the sand and be like, hey, let's play in the sand together. Let's do this game together to try to build that relationship up. And then maybe a little later, when things feel safer, they'll be more equipped to navigate things themselves.
Yeah. I love when those moments happen, when you can see those happen and they unfold in the playroom, when the relationship, you can see the trust growing and you can see the child take those risks and maybe they feel empowered and they're like, yeah, I'm gonna go check out that thing, and they just go for it, and it's amazing.
I agree. Empowerment and like courage, you know, I think that's, and safety, I think, when they're coming in and they don't feel that just yet. You know, I think if we dig in our heels and think like, well, I'm, you know, it's up to her. She's going to have to be the one that leads this. We can cause harm if we're making the situation feel even more anxiety inducing for them. So I think we need to meet them where they are. And then later, when they're feeling more empowered and safe, like you said, then we can watch them start to dip their toe into into little independence.
Absolutely. And the independence is just so wonderful when they can get to that space.
Yes.
One of my favorite
things. Rely on
to
you
see.
Less.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this balance of those two things, it's very intricate. And I love talking with people about how they find that balance. And I think it is a hard skill to get to and to understand. Did you feel comfortable with that right away, or was that something that also took kind of practice for you as a therapist?
That's a great question. I think it's funny, when I was in grad school and really didn't know a lot about play therapy yet, I would get on Pinterest and see all kinds of amazing, like super directive activity ideas. And I was pinning things like crazy. Oh, I'm totally going to do that if a child is anxious. I'm going to do that one if a child is angry. And then when I learned more about play therapy, I went in the far opposite end of the spectrum and loved Gary Landreth, loved Virginia Axline, very much pioneers and non-directive, and was like, I am not going to do anything to push a child ever, no direction, no nothing. And then, you know, as you really start to see more clients and get more experienced, started to realize, okay, this really isn't a one-size-fits-all situation. It works amazingly well for some kids, and I feel like it's not productive for other kids. And so it's been nice giving myself permission really to not be so aligned with one particular approach that I lose sight of what might actually be helpful.
Yeah, giving permission, especially in relation to approaches, it's definitely hard to do, especially like when you say you dive into one and you're so in love with it. And but there is so much of that our guts tell us, like you said, the example of a kiddo coming in and really struggling. We know our therapeutic gut is like, no, I can't do this.
Exactly. Like listening to that gut instinct of being like, this just feels wrong, like to watch you sit here and struggle. And there are certain elements of therapy where you are allowing a child to work through something while you're there and supporting them, and that might look like struggle, but I think it doesn't quite hit on this discomfort inside of you quite so strongly if you're doing the right thing.
Yes, going with that gut. I love it. This actually goes into my next question. You have this beautiful sentence and explanation on your website, and I'm going to read it really quickly, but then maybe you can elaborate for us. It says, most often I take a strengths-based, person-centered approach to therapy because I believe clients are the experts of their own experiences and need mostly support and guidance from therapists in order to confidently lead their lives. And I love how this touches on that humanistic approach that we were just going over. But can you tell us more about how clients are the experts of their own experiences?
Absolutely. So while I might be the expert, so to speak, in the room on child development and what's normal and not and effective communication, that does not make me the expert of that child. I have no idea what it's like to parent this child. I have no idea what it's like to be this child, to live in her home with her family and attend her school. And I don't have any idea what it's like to be in her body or in her mind. So I believe that my most important job in the playroom is to build a safe and trusting relationship with a child so that they might feel comfortable showing me what it's like to be them, or to show me what their struggles and fears are. And that connection extends outward into other strategies. So if a child is crossing boundaries, if they're hurting me or themselves or hurting items in the playroom, I set firm limits and I stick to them, but I'm maintaining an understanding stance the whole time. Or if a child is really dependent on me and refuses to try things on their own, I refuse to play into that, but I'm still showing them so much empathy and support at the same time. So I really believe that children grow and get better by being in positive, secure attachments with others and by feeling fully accepted as they are right now, flaws and all.
Absolutely. It's so powerful, incredibly powerful.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it makes a difference to feel like you're in the presence of somebody who likes you and wants to be around you and accepts you for whatever it is you're doing. So sometimes they're showing really challenging behaviors, and it can be really healing to be around a regulated adult who is still going to respond to them with care and support and still show fondness for them. I still look forward to seeing you. I'm still excited when you pop up in my reading room, even if last week you had a really hard moment in my playroom.
Yes, like that unconditional positive regard there.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And you kind of touched on this, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more for our listeners who may not know as much about play therapy. Can you tell us about how, when the child may show you when they're crossing boundaries or when they refuse to play into certain things, can you tell us a little bit about how that informs what you do in the therapy room, how you kind of take that information? What does it mean to you? How do you synthesize that as a therapist?
Absolutely. Great question. So If we take a kiddo, for example, who has asked to be able to do something, maybe they think it would be lots of fun to, let me think of an example. Maybe think it'd be lots of fun to paint the walls of my playroom because I have paint in there. So they think that this would be so much fun. I come at that with like, oh, I get how that would be so much fun. You know, I'm not coming in from a place of wanting to control their immediate behavior. If they put a little paint on the wall, it's not the end of the world. I can take it off. That being said, I'm not going to stand by and let them paint the walls red either. So I can come in a really friendly tone and be like, oh, that looks like so much fun to paint the walls. The walls aren't really for painting. The paper is for painting. And a lot of the times when I can come at it from a really like empathetic place and not come in harshly of like, no, we don't paint the walls. You're supposed to paint the paper. A lot of times that helps them cooperate more. They feel like I understand where they're coming from and I'm providing them some kind of alternative. Hey, switch your attention to the thing I'm saying yes to, which is paper. And let's not focus on the thing I'm saying no to, which is painting the wall. So it's like a nice balance of providing empathy while still setting a limit and giving them some other kind of option.
Yeah. Do you find that empathetic, it's really like the empathy first element of that statement, mm-hmm. where that's the first thing that comes out of your mouth. It's not like confrontational. Mm-hmm. Do you find that kids are more apt to listen and kind of take that suggestion and follow that boundary because you're validating really first?
Absolutely. That's what all of us are looking for at the end of the day. We all want to feel like other people understand why we want to do something or understand how we feel about something. And so starting off with an empathetic place tends to make them a bit more cooperative. If it doesn't work, if they continue to want to paint on the walls, it helps that I don't see that as a failure on my part, nor am I thinking negative thoughts about them. I'm not thinking, oh, I did that limit wrong. They just keep doing it. And I'm not thinking like, oh, what's wrong with them that they keep doing it. The kind of verbiage I have in my mind is, wow, this is a really hard thing for them to hear a no on. This is really important to them. And it seems like they're really needing to feel like they have a say in this situation. So I would never expect parents to do this outside the playroom, but inside the playroom, it's a different environment. And as long as nobody's getting hurt, I'm going to continue to repeat that pretty patiently. Like, oh, I see that you're choosing to keep putting paint on the wall. You really want to do it so much, but paint isn't for putting on the wall in here. It's for putting on paper. So I just keep repeating that a few times if they're having a tougher time. And many of the time, that's really all that's needed to help them kind of move through that moment and accept the limit. If not, then they kind of go into the next sort of strategy.
Yes. I love how there's almost like this golden nugget that you just gave, how if you're able to remove your own judgment of, even if it's judging yourself about how you said something about a limit or is it okay that there's paint on the mm-hmm. wall or all those different things, if you're able to kind of step back and remove that and gather that information, they feel like they really need this control right now. That is so important mm-hmm. to them. And we could miss that so easily if we're caught up in some of those other things, that kind of chattery things that can be there.
It is. And that's one of the tougher parts about being a therapist, is being aware of what's going on internally in yourself mm-hmm. all the time, all the while that you're watching what's going on in this child. And so absolutely, I have days where I can feel like my frustration rise and I think like, oh, why are they still doing it? I set that limit so beautifully. And I have to notice that frustration is there and kind of take a second and breathe and remind myself once again, it's not the end of the world if a little paint is on the wall. It's washable. I can get it off. It's okay. And that allows me to kind of go back into it with renewed compassion and really see the struggle for them.
Yes, that's so, so well said. And I love how you can hone in on that in the play therapy room when you're honing in on those experiences and really seeing how a kid's really struggling and they're just really, really needing something. And that just brings that empathy to the forefront and such important information to not miss too.
Yes. Well, and it's funny. I feel like I learned this lesson a million times and still have to relearn it. I'm thinking about it even now, but it's almost ironic the subtleties that happen. You're both going through same experiences at the same time. You know, they're wanting the control of being able to say and do what they want. And I'm wanting to control the situation by having them not paint the wall anymore. So both of us are inwardly struggling with control, but the one who's going to have to end that pattern is me. The child is never going to be the one that's like, you know, I'm having an issue with control in this moment. It's really hard for me to stop painting, and we're not going to have like a lovely conversation about it. It has to be me who stops that pattern. Yes.
That's such a good example. A really great picture to think of. Therapy would be so easy if we could do that.
That would be so much easier if they could just really be way would. More mature than I ever am. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Our job would be done. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, man. The boundaries, I think, with non-directive work are really interesting and is really a common question of with child-centered. How do you set boundaries? Is there no boundaries? Yes. What does this kind of look like? Yeah, is it a free-for-all? Or, but you've already explained really well how important boundaries are and how informative the boundary experience is in itself as well.
Exactly. And I think that's the beauty of non-directive that you're talking about, that you can use whatever the child is giving you in the moment. There's not necessarily a need to sit a child down and say like, oh, you're being defiant and oppositional at home. Let's talk about why you're doing that. And you shouldn't do that. You should listen to mom and dad. Like that kind of stuff isn't helpful. It can sometimes just be in the moment with the child. They're going to bring in whatever it is that they're dealing with outside of the room, and you get the opportunity to work with it live in the moment. You're learning like, okay, it is really hard for them to hear a no if they really want to do it. And instead of digging in my heels and getting caught up in that same loop, we're able to kind of calmly work through it together.
Yeah, like a co-experience where you're both working through it. It's, you know, two people in the playroom. Let's dig a little bit more into play. With the power, as a play therapist, you know how powerful play can be. Was this something that you were always aware of as a therapist, or did you stumble upon this in a different way? What was that experience like?
I did kind of stumble upon play therapy. It's so interesting to me to relive that. I was in grad school with full intentions of being a couples therapist, and I took a like intro to play therapy course, something that was required by my university, and something just clicked. I wouldn't say that I had been bad at working with adults by any means, but it was a little bit more of a struggle. It felt like something I was having to go home and study my skills and restudy and really concentrate on. And play therapy just came to me much more naturally. And I went, okay, maybe I'm going to consider a little bit of a change here. And I was fortunate to go to a school that had several play therapy courses. I took all of them that were offered and just absolutely loved it.
That is so cool. I do hear a lot of people say that where they were going to school for, if it's for therapy or for something else, and then they take a course on one thing and it just opens up the world and is a total shift.
Exactly. It was a whole shift. And I had heard of play therapy before, but idea of what it was nothing of what it really is. And so learning, you know, just the basic foundation, the basic beliefs of play therapy was like mind blowing. Like, oh my gosh, this changes everything. This is what I'm going to do instead.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little more how, from a play therapist perspective, how does play help build those therapeutic foundations, help children grow, and help them move towards different goals in their work?
Yeah. So I've had the pleasure of working with children from all kinds of backgrounds and experiencing all kinds of challenges. And it's amazing to see how play therapy never fails to meet them where they are. And that looks different with every child. Before I was in private practice, I worked at nonprofit agencies with children who were coming from domestic violence or sexual assault. And I've seen children who've experienced a lot of interpersonal trauma who then use their dolls or puppets to play out their trauma. And sometimes that can look really literal, which I think is what the general public tend to think of when they think of play therapy, is like there's a dad doll and there's a baby doll and dad doll's being unkind to baby doll. But sometimes it happens metaphorically as well. Children use their toys to express what it is that they need to get off their minds. So sometimes in a metaphorical sense, it might be that one dinosaur is mean to another dinosaur and they're having to work through that. And in some ways it's not even about necessarily the toys or things that are using. Sometimes it becomes more about our relationship. A child who is experiencing abuse at home may need to control the environment in the playroom more than the average child. And it's about being able to let them play out their need as they can, and yet also still sticking to those boundaries. So sometimes kiddos have been through scary things and they put me through similar scary things that they've been through. And I will absolutely set boundaries. I won't let myself get hurt. I won't let them get hurt. But aside from that, I will let them play that out as they need to. Hope that makes sense.
Yes, it definitely makes sense. And I'm curious about in those moments when you're in the play, whether the child wants to make you feel scared or however that's occurring mm-hmm. in the playroom, what is your role with those feelings when they're acting those out? Is it, are you kind of holding it for them or are you acting it out? What does that look like, I guess?
Great question. Yeah, so a number of different things are happening all at once when you're a play therapist. So if a child is saying to me, like, I'm going to pretend to be this bad guy and you're going to be the victim that I'm attacking, there's a playful component, but it's also just wanting to make sure you don't do something that they don't want you to do. So I'm going to be like, okay, you want me to play the victim. Should I ask you not to do things? Should I get scared? Should I cry? What should that look like? And so I take guidance from them on what that victim should look like. Maybe their thought is that the victim doesn't care. Or maybe the victim gets really upset, or maybe the victim fights back. I don't want to assume that I'm supposed to do things one way if in their minds what's helpful to them is to see it done a different way. So there's that part, just kind of checking in with kiddo, like, hey, am I doing this the way you want? There's also me constantly asking myself, like, what is this doing for them? What is helpful about this situation? Does it feel powerful for them to play the role of the attacker instead of the victim? Does it feel scary to have that much power? And I am, at the same time, commenting some on what I'm experiencing. So if they're the scary person and I'm the victim, I might kind of make little comments about, like, oh, it makes me feel a little scared when I have to sit in this corner by myself. I feel lonely that I don't have anyone in the corner with me. Or if they say unkind things to me, I'm still And you know, as a side note, I suppose it's not so much that I truly, my own feelings are hurt or that I truly am feeling lonely. It's more that I'm wanting to give voice to what that victim role feels like, to start to kind of plant seeds for the kiddo. If they're the victim in their lives, putting voice to this feels lonely, this feels scary, this is sad. So just wanted to be clear. It's not so much that I'm telling the kid, like, you're scaring me right now, or I'm lonely and need attention. But
Yes.
definitely commenting on that and still at the same time commenting on their experience. Oh, you feel really powerful as the bad guy. You really want me to feel scared, and I do feel scared right now.
Wow. It's really interesting to hear how you're navigating all of these different things at the same time. It's all happening at once, and it's very intense too. And really trying to hash out, okay, is it this role that they're playing? And, you know, what are they feeling in that moment? Are they digging into this? What do I lean into? And what is the thing that I guess is kind of louder in the moment? It sounds tiring and exciting at the same time, because so much is happening in the moment. But it sounds like it can be so powerful when you find the right route to go on.
Yes, 100%. When you're kind of attuned and you feel like your boundaries are being held and you're feeling regulated and it feels like things are productive for them, they're getting something out of this. It is a lot of mental effort, but I would say it's more rejuvenating than exhausting. I mean, it's certainly intense, but when the session's over, you find that it's like, oh my gosh, wow, that was amazing what they were working through and the strengths and skills they had to do that. More that. And then later on, sure, you are like, okay,
Had a
I'm
long
ready
day.
for, yes, I'm ready for some self-care here.
That's such a perfect word, rejuvenating, because I feel that in my sessions too. I think that's a great way to explain it. Do you find that they're easier to hash those things out in the moment?
I think so. I think especially when you're starting out, you know, grad programs can't prepare you for every single situation you're going to come across. And so in the beginning, when something inevitably comes up that you've never experienced anything like before, it can be very rattling and, oh, I don't really know what to say to this. What's the right thing to do or the right thing to say? And you really learn as you go along. There's not necessarily one specific route. Obviously, of course, like you're not wanting to say or do things that cause harm. But outside of that, helping can look in a number of different ways. And as my experience builds, I often have kind of a blueprint for something. I may not experience exactly the same situation, but I have a blueprint for like something similar has happened to me before 2 years ago, and this is what I did about that. So I would say in that way, it does become easier. And also, kids still find interesting things to throw at you sometimes.
Always, always. I got to keep you on your
Always,
toes.
yes.
Sometimes you're like, oh, maybe not today. Nope, every time. They'll
Nope,
find a
I
way.
was not prepared for this moment. Yes.
Yes.
Well, and even, you know, stepping outside of the interpersonal trauma area, general basic behavior challenges or things like anxiety, play can kind of meet children where they are and help provide a lot of calm and consistency, and that alone can be really healing.
Yeah, just like being in that space,
Just
for
being in that
sure.
space, and you know, if we take anger, for example, children having anger problems can be really intense for their parents. And so sometimes parents inadvertently respond to kids' anger in ways that aren't helpful. And so it's like that cycle just repeats over and over. And so then if a child comes to me and is having a really tough moment in the playroom, I'm talking like full on hitting, yelling, the whole nine yards, but they're having this episode in front of an adult who is regulated and prepared to respond to it. it can change the tide. It really does.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because this is going to throw us into the book that you have that you released not too long ago. So how does that tide change in those situations when they've come to rely on that space and move through that anger experience?
Great question. I think it goes back to what we were talking earlier about the wonders of non-directive play therapy and the importance of building that relationship. So they're used to responding to something with anger and maybe getting pushback. And so their response is to dig in their heels. They're really used to sort of, you know, completing that formula, so to speak. You know, it's like first we get A, then it's B, and then I'm going to put in C and we'll go from there. And when they put out A and I all of a sudden bring in X, it's suddenly like, well, what do I do from here? I guess I just am calm. This changes things for me. And it's not a magic bullet by any means. I've absolutely had kids yelling, kicking, upset in a session. We get through it and then we do the same thing the next session. But what I observe over time is like, okay, that first time the meltdown lasted 25 minutes and the second time it really was only like 10 or 15. So we're decreasing the amount of time we're needing to spend in that meltdown before we're able to regulate and get calm again. And part of that too, when I set limits with kids, there's three steps to them: empathy, limit, and then I try to provide some kind of alternative. And I think that can make a big difference for kids too, because lots of times grownups in their lives are saying like, okay, you're mad, but you can't hit me. And then we don't say anything after that. And that angry energy doesn't just disappear from their bodies because they're told not to hit. So in the playroom, I can say, hey, I know you're really angry with me right now, but I'm not for hitting. You can hit the pillow or you can hit the teddy bear instead. I'm giving them something else that they can do with that anger. And they often do. So you have the calming piece of the empathy. You're basically thrusting coping skills upon them. And with some time and some patience, it starts to sink in for them.
Yeah, I really love how you explained that, the idea that you're holding that space for them to experience that and you're guiding them to figure out an appropriate way to do it rather than kind of like coming down in this authoritarian, you can't do this thing, but you're helping them reshape the experience in the moment.
Yes, that's so important. And you know, we were talking earlier about there is a real place for directive activities and teaching skills in certain areas, but nothing beats being able to learn in the moment. It's so tough for even kids that try the absolute hardest to learn about breathing when they're calm and then remember to do that when they're angry. And children aren't meant to be able to remember that stuff. They really do need a grown-up who can sit with them and be like, you're really mad right now. Let's take a deep breath together. And I think a big piece of it too, just can't underestimate the importance of the empathy and normalizing and validating of feelings. Like, it's okay that you're mad at me, even if the reason is ridiculous, even if it's just that I turned the light switch on before you were ready for me to. Okay, well, arguing with you about the logic behind the reason you're mad is not going to work for us here. So instead, I have to go into a place of, oh, I understand you're really upset about that. You really wanted to turn on the light switch yourself. And so often, if they just feel like someone understands where they're coming from, it's a very calming, regulating strategy.
Absolutely.
Again, just like us adults. I mean, if you have a bad day at work and come home and you're slamming doors a little harder than necessary or being a bit of a grump, if your spouse or your roommate is like, what's your problem? Why are you being like that? It's not that big of a deal. that just adds fuel to the fire, right?
So
At least
much.
it does for me.
It
but
does.
If somebody's, yes.
Kind of slam the cupboards and just, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's
exactly.
Totally
like, yeah, exactly. You're like, I don't know why you're so mad about what your boss said. Like, they're always rude to you. Like, that kind of stuff doesn't help us. We want somebody
No.
to say, hey, it looks like something's wrong. It looks like you're having a tough moment. Do you want to talk about it? And then it's not like the anger just immediately disappears, but it is like a breath out. Like, okay, I can talk about this and feel better from it.
Yes, it's so validating and powerful when you know you're accepted, heard,
Yes.
you know, whether someone understands it or not, if you're slapping covers or doing whatever you need to do, it's just, it feels.
Yes. Yes. That last part is so true. Even if it doesn't make any sense to me and I don't get it, I'm just going to accept that that's how you feel and try to support you in it. Yes.
Yes. That support. So wonderful. And actually, you recently published a book about this topic. It's called Anger Management Skills Workbook for Kids. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this book is about? How do therapists use this book in or outside of their sessions? Can you tell us a little bit more?
Absolutely. So as of course we said, I'm mostly non-directive with children. I do absolutely see a place for directive activities though. Sometimes I think kids really want an opportunity to discuss something or to express concern about something, but they need an invitation to do so. It doesn't feel right to barge in the playroom and start putting that out there. And there are certain situations where I'm really needing to teach a child a skill. It could be a relaxation skill. It could be that after a sexual abuse incident, we're needing to learn about good touch, bad touch, and things like that. So with directive activities, like we were saying earlier, it really is finding that right balance between A, opening up that subject for discussion, but also be finding something that meets the child where they are and feels safe and engaging for them. If a child doesn't feel interested in an activity or doesn't feel safe with it, they're not going to do it, period. So my creative process is to take the topic area, whatever that may be, and try to find a way to combine it with the child's interest, whether they like games best or art or other kinds of expressive activities. So even the same subject can be done so many different ways. You know, if I have a child who is processing feelings from divorce, I can combine that into a game. I can make an art activity about it. I've even, in the past, I had a client who really loved miniature cars, and I wrote feelings words on a piece of paper and turned those spots into little parking spots and gave them cars and said, park the car on whichever feelings words are right here. So I try to really meet them where they are, figure out what they're interested in, and combine that with the therapeutic part of things.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like so much fun too. Getting so creative.
It is. It is
new ideas.
It is. There are moments when I can get stuck and be like, oh man, I'm not sure what to do with this. But so often it helps to just sit back and be like, okay, what is this kid like? She is all about the art. Okay, how can we make this into an art project? And so how the book actually happened, I have a professional Instagram account and I sometimes offer ideas for therapeutic activities. So that's mainly geared more toward therapists. And then I also make a lot of posts about how to respond to kids when they're saying or doing challenging things. And that's intended for parents and therapists alike. And my book really feels like kismet to me, so to speak, because Penguin Random House, the publisher, was looking to publish a workbook for children on anger, and an editor actually came upon my Instagram and asked if I would be interested in writing that workbook. It was Such a wonderful surprise. It's so amazing. Yes.
What a serendipitous and just like, you know, you're putting your hard work out there too. And that an opportunity like that can come from Instagram.
It's how amazing. So amazing. It was very exciting. I am a person who's had a lifelong dream of publishing a book, and I've, you know, come up with ideas and submitted things before, and getting turned down is part of the process, but certainly disappointing. And in some ways it's like, wow, what a bizarre note on the modern world that it was Instagram that got me into that.
Right. It speaks volumes to your content too, of how important and how much it's resonating with people who need it.
Thank
too.
You. Yeah. I put a lot of effort into it. Sometimes it seems a little silly. I'll have moments of being like, it's just Instagram, but other moments I get an idea and I feel so passionately about it, and I can write forever in the caption, and people probably are thinking like, why does she write so much? It's Instagram. But it's really enjoyable to me, and I think it really helps meet that desire I have to write. I've always enjoyed writing, and Instagram kind of gives me an easy way to do that.
Yeah, it's so open and you can share things so quickly. There's endless opportunities. I just had a similar thing happen today. I kind of happenstance landed on this one thing and went to the original post, and it was this very lengthy thing, but I feel like it's almost like reading articles sometimes, because you're coming across such enlightening information, and a great place to connect with those people and find your people and a support network too. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I agree. I love what you said about like finding your people, because it's so great when you stumble upon a play therapist or some sort of person who has similar therapeutic ideals as you, and they're living like in California or the UK or something. And it's just so cool to be able to join in with them on that passion.
Yeah, join forces. Yes.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Kind of like we're doing now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely. I love hearing how therapists are also creative, kind of like outside work, even though if it's work related, but it's your creative pursuits.
Yes.
And especially as creative arts therapists, we're called on that all the time to, you know, like your mini car example, like we've got to tap into those things. Yeah. With your book, and maybe this goes into some more anger management skill stuff in general, but what are some tips that you would give to therapists who are working with children who may have some anger issues?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the tips, you know, there's things you can do beforehand in preparation, and stuff to do in the moment and stuff to do afterward. So beforehand, you know, I think it really is so important, if you're about to go into a session, to remind yourself even that if a child has a hard moment in the session, it's really not about you. Yes, it might be triggered by something that you say or do, like telling them not to paint the wall or turning off the light switch at the wrong moment. It might be triggered by something you do, but that doesn't mean it's about you. And I think being able to keep that perspective in mind helps the therapist remain calm and regulated, and not be judging themselves inwardly or even judging the child for the behavior. But yeah, I think if you're wanting activities, first of all, feel free to grab some from my book, because it's chock full of them. But find activities or things that normalize anger and don't shame the child for things they've done. Really don't want to sit them down and be like, hey, I hear you're giving mom and dad a hard time at home, or why did you hit your little sister? By the time a child is coming to see a therapist, they're getting in trouble on a regular basis and often don't feel good about themselves. They really need someone to tell them that not only do all humans get angry sometimes, we also all have made mistakes when we're angry. We've all said and done things that we didn't feel good about afterwards. And that's not done to excuse the child's behavior, but just to let them know, like, you're not alone. You're very much human. You're just having a bit of a tough time and you need some extra support in this. So beforehand preparation is really helpful. In the moment, if something happens and a kiddo is having a really angry reaction, they're aggressive or they're yelling at you, first and foremost, just know that it's completely understandable if you find that hard to deal with and respond to. It's really intense to handle another person's anger. Especially, you know, they've got that red face, they're throwing things, they're hitting you. It's a lot to take. So, you know, don't beat yourself too much if you have a gut reaction of just wanting it to stop. However, we also know that trying to control things or trying to put a stop to it quickly, it's understandable because you're in your office and your child's yelling and you're thinking, oh gosh, other therapists in this office are being interrupted right now. I need to make it stop right now. While that's human, that doesn't work. We can't put a stop to it immediately. So what I think is helpful is to have a shift in mindset. So instead of seeing this child as out of control, as angry and aggressive, if I can instead see them as someone who's having a hard time and needs my help, that instantly changes how I respond to them. Seeing somebody as needing help makes me speak more calmly and compassionately and kind of renews my interest as opposed to feeling like I need to stop this right now. And so, you know, that kind of falls on basic limit setting. You're really angry right now, but I'm not for hitting. You can hit the pillow as hard as you want, but I'm not for hitting. And then I even go so far, if the hitting continues to happen and it's hurting you, I say, oh, I can see that it's really hard for you to stop hitting me, so I'm going to help you just by holding your hands down. Let me know when you're ready to stop hitting and I'll let go of your hands. So of course, not holding hands hard. This isn't a punishment. It's just that I'm going to help you stop hitting me because it's hard for you to stop that yourself. And you want to say those things. You want to say all of the stuff about trying to help them and things being hard for them. And when they tell you that they're ready to stop hitting, then you can let go. And then the last piece is what I call the aftercare, really. When things are calm and okay again, they're no longer acting aggressively, I try again to reconnect with them and be really soothing. So I might offer for us to go get a drink of water together, or sit and read a book together, or even offering hugs sometimes. I think that when adults get angry, we don't necessarily want touch, but kids aren't necessarily the same thing. They might be. You can offer it. And if they're like, no, don't touch me. Okay. Totally cool. I will respect that. But yeah, I know that there, as therapists, sometimes we can feel a little bit wary of touch, but sometimes when you've had an angry meltdown, you just want a hug. So putting that out there can be really soothing. And then I even like to say to the child, would you like me to let mom know that today was really extra tough so that she can give you extra hugs tonight? It's not at all that I'm going to go out and tell mom like, hey, James was really rough back there. He was hitting me and breaking all kinds of rules. If they agree to it, I'm actually going to walk them out and be like, hey, mom, just so you know, James had a tough day today and he might need some extra hugs tonight. I'll say it that exact same way. But of course, if the child doesn't want me to tell mom anything, that's totally fine too. But when I word it that way, kids almost always are like, yes, you can tell mom. Yeah. And then when the session is over and you go home, you self-care like crazy. Take a bubble bath, like cry, let yourself have all of the feelings because it is a lot and you're human and it's okay if it has an impact on you.
Definitely. Yeah, it's so important to hold those feelings for ourselves. I love how you explained the boundary between kind of the confidentiality between the child and parent, but informing the parent if the child says it's okay. But I love that it's with the child's approval. And so the parent is in that healing process as well, and they're right there.
Exactly. Bringing them into the healing process and kind of trying to give them a subtle heads up. You know, I might try to send them a little bit of a message with my eyes, not in a way that gets kiddo in trouble, but just kind of like trying to subtly send the message that they might continue to be irritable after this. Maybe just remember like extra hugs and extra patience. But yeah, absolutely inviting them into that healing process. And I find when I word things that way, I always get great responses from parents. They're always quick to be like, oh, was it tough for you, James? Oh, I'm sorry. Like maybe we need to snuggle when we get home or watch a movie together. Yeah.
How are some other ways that you find, and maybe especially with anger too, or if there's other ways or other tips, but helping parents navigate anger as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So just like I said, that it's important to normalize anger and reduce shame with the kiddos, it's equally important to do this with parents. So parents of children with emotional challenges and angry outbursts often feel very alone in that. They might be asking friends and family like, hey, did your child do this when they were 4, 6, or 8? And they might be getting no's in response and just feeling like whatever they're doing is not right. They're not doing a good job. And they may have even said or done things in the heat of the moment with an angry child, like yelling or saying hurtful words that they feel terrible about. And I think the first step as therapists is validating their humanness and saying, yeah, it's really hard when someone is in your face yelling and being aggressive. Yes. Like it makes sense that you tried to protect yourself because it is so hard, and making them feel bad for the things they've done is not fair and it's not going to help them do things differently. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to tell parents, like, while that is so hard to stay calm, it is actually possible to stay calm. I can help you learn how to be in the presence of someone's anger or even be the target of someone's anger without joining them in it.
Yeah.
So rather than thinking in your mind, they're making me look bad as a parent, I need to get control of the situation right now, change that script to, wow, my child is having a hard time and they need my help.
Yes,
mindset shift. Yeah, the subtle change in script makes a huge difference for how you then respond to them. And then definitely I teach them about empathy, as we've talked about. You know, even if it just seems ridiculous, like you told them they can't have a popsicle at 10 o'clock at night and you never let them have popsicles at 10 o'clock at night. Even if it doesn't make sense, just really putting energy into trying to be understanding. Like, I understand a popsicle would be delicious right now, but we're for going to bed. So the empathy piece is so important. And making sure, too, that limits at home or consequences are really consistent. So if a child hears a no and gets really angry, and then that ends up turning to a yes just to make them stop, well, the child has then just learned that that technique will work for them. And so it makes total sense that they're going to repeat that technique in the future. And you know, you might be making it harder for yourself in the sense that if you held out for a really long time and then gave in, now they might give you a tougher time in the future because they'll think, oh, well, last time it took an hour of melting down before mom gave in. So I'm gonna stick with it for an hour and 5 minutes this time. I'm making a joke. Children don't truly think things through that consciously, of course. They learn these strategies unconsciously, and then when a need is not being fulfilled, they will find a way to have it filled.
Yes, they're very adaptable and really good at that.
Yes. They really are. They're ingenious. I know so many kids who are just like expert, like negotiators. Like, well, I tried strategy A and it didn't work, so let's shift to strategy B next. And sometimes you just kind of have to laugh at like the genius of it all.
Yeah, there's so much creativity with it. It's always like kind of puts me beside myself watching kids when they do those things, because I'm like, wow, just if I could peek inside your brain, you're thinking so creatively and problem solving. And
yes.
But I don't want to encourage it, you know, too much with some of that stuff. But yeah, it's great.
I know. I've had so many moments of kids who aren't necessarily having angry reactions, but they keep repeating the same request over and over. And it's such a common thing that parents report too. So maybe they ask me 100 times, can I play with the sandbox on the couch? And I've said 100 times very carefully, the sand is not for playing with on the couch, but you are welcome to play with it on the floor. And they're still repeating it. And there have been so many opportunities where I've said to kids, you know, I think that you think if you keep asking me that question that I might change my mind. And so many kids have been like, yeah.
Guilty.
I just love like their honesty. Like, yes, it is exactly what I was trying to do. And I'm like, okay, I understand, but I'm actually not going to change my mind. And then they're like, okay, like they're ready to move on after that. But I love the honesty.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And then they're caught and they're, you know, you've called my bluff and
exactly. You called my bluff. Like, I can no longer continue using this strategy, so I might as well stop. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So ingenious, so adaptable, creative. Oh my goodness. I love it.
They really are. That's what's so wonderful about working with kids. You never know what they're going to throw at you, and it's wonderful.
It really is. I love it. I love it. This has been so, so informative, digging into all of these tips and hearing about the power of play and, you know, anger, how to respond to anger. And I'll be sure to link to that in our show notes. But could you also tell us where our listeners can contact or find you as well on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Instagram, my handle is @AmandaRobinson_LPC_RPT. I also have a website with a small blog. Often the blog is similar stuff to my Instagram posts, but there are a few things that are different. And that is AmandaRobinsonLPC.com. And then emails, kind of the same theme here, amanda.robinson.lpc@gmail.com.
Awesome. Those will also all be linked in the show notes too, so people can just go quickly
Fantastic.
And click on them and get there. I am a huge fan of yours on Instagram, and that like almost everything that you post, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Like quadruple tap, love, love, love it.
And thank you. I know. It's funny because I often make posts about things that I just had to relearn, you know, 20 minutes before. I'm like, why did I not remember that, you know, this strategy works with kids? And so half the time the things that I'm posting are things that I'm learning myself or trying to remind myself of.
Yes, I love that. I feel like I do that very, very similarly.
It's no, growth, it is certainly know? Not. I've pretty much accepted at this point that I will be learning these lessons for the rest of my life. And I've come to accept that. Yes.
Yes. guests. This has just been so, so wonderful having you here. Thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences, your passion. You shared so much knowledge. Just thank you so much for being here.
This was so great. Thank you so much for bringing me on. This was a lot of fun.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I know that I am going to take all of these different tips that Amanda had and really sit with them. And again, I'll probably have to relearn them like we were saying on the end of the episode. They'll come back and then I'll have to go back to them and that circular kind of learning. But I just loved all these tips, especially for working with kids who maybe are having, if it's they're feeling angry within a session or they're having more substantial anger issues, which can be really hard because like we had talked about earlier in the episode, there's so much of our own dynamic and our own feelings that we have to keep in check in the moment and, you know, navigating issues of safety while you're doing all of this, but also being able to respond. And it's such a nuanced place when working with anger. And Amanda just had such great, great tips, great insight throughout this whole episode. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you guys did too. I want to remind everyone that there are the anonymous surveys that are located, it's one survey. The anonymous survey is located at the bottom of the show notes. And that is for you to voice your opinion in any way you see fit. Let us know if you have questions, suggestions, concerns, if you want to call us out on something. That is what it's there for. So always also feel free to email me to creativetherapyumbrella@gmail.com. I love hearing from listeners no matter what it is that you want to talk about. So I'm all ears. Also, if you have a minute, one of the best ways that you can give back to us over here at Creative Therapy Umbrella is by writing obviously I hope it's a 5-star review, but writing a review for us on Apple Podcasts. This is, you know, podcasts, we put them out for free. There's a lot of work behind the scenes and I love doing this work so, so much. But this is a way to help it, help the podcast become more sustainable. Because what happens is when you give us 5 stars and you write us a review, it helps other people who are looking for our podcast. It kind of brings us up to them more frequently. So that helps spread the word. It helps in so many ways. And it's such a small thing that you can do. So I encourage you, if you have one free minute, go and leave us a little review and give us those hopefully 5-star rating. And if not, too, tell us what we're missing. If you don't feel like we're 5 stars, if something's, tell me. I want to know. I really do. I love feedback. I love constructive criticism. So I'd really love to hear what we can do to make the podcast better fit your needs if we're missing something. So thank you guys so much for listening. I hope that you are all doing well as we move into October. Sending you guys all the best and be creative.